I can't believe these introductions at all. They're like letters of recommendation. No one believes them. No one believes them. There's one border that I have not been too happy to cross. That's the one between that separates us, Hadrian's Wall. I did spend 5 years in England, and I was delighted to become an American. We're waiting for the English to have their bourgeois revolution, and they'll probably have it as soon as the French have their workers' revolution, after 3 big failures. I make a career out of the interstitial space between disciplines. I'm undisciplined, and the last of the Scottish amateurs. I've no idea what your backgrounds are, and I have some slides for those of you who are visual and you're just waiting to see the visuals. The architects typically, although it has become a verbal discipline recently, they may have something to do with what I'm saying. But if I take too long in this, we won't see them at all, because it'll end up being something quite different. A couple of things that Tom did not tell you about was that I've been attempting to teach for about 8 years a course which began as interpretations of technology, and then we felt self-inflated and changed its title to Philosophies of Technology. Probably would be better called Interpretations, but as I learn more and more on hermeneutics, I realize that Philosophies is probably a better word than interpretation. And the kind of texts we use there are Ortega y Gasset and Martin Heidegger. Ortega y Gasset's Thoughts on Technology and Martin Heidegger's paper, The Question Concerning Technology. You'll remember that the architects invited Ortega and Heidegger to the Man in Space conference in 1951 at Darmstadt because they themselves felt they couldn't say too much about space, so those were the two philosophers. I'm particularly interested in what they say about technology, although we are interested in Heidegger's building dwelling thinking, and we're all obsessed by being and time. We try to get an American version, and because Lewis Mumford taught at Penn, we do use Technics and Civilization. And I think one of the most important texts for me in my class is Walter Benjamin's article, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. So we begin by having a look at technology there, and you'll see there's a bias towards a defrocked Christian existentialism, which is a kind of atheism, which becomes a sort of hermeneutic phenomenology. And I suppose, as this has been said, everywhere you only confront yourself. So here I am, 30 years after being a young Scottish boy, going back to Christian existentialism without Christianity. And so Heidegger is very important in our course. The other courses I teach, one on the history of iron and steel, reinforced concrete in Europe and America, and it's not the standard version. Another course I'm trying to teach, which brings me closer to Tom, is one on the science, ethics, and aesthetics of engineering structures, case study, The Bridge. And I do that because I designed 2 bridges, one of which has been built, and as a student I wanted to build bridges. And now I live between bridges. I thought we'd be sitting around a table. There would be about a dozen of us, and we all would have read the same things, so you would know where I would be plagiarizing, and I would not be worried about that. And out of the Benjamin work, out of Heidegger and then Benjamin, and the modern, postmodern debate in architecture, and the revival of the interest in the classical language of architecture, I have become interested in the metamorphosis of perception in the architectural culture, and I'm particularly interested in the metamorphosis of perception through production. And I've written the paper, thinking I'd have been here for lunch and had some wine, and we've not, so I might throw away the paper. In his lecture on the question concerning technology, Martin Heidegger declares that questioning builds a way. And elsewhere he says that, quote, the question itself is a path, and that questions are only worth asking of that which is worth questioning. Of that, quote, which is questionable in a sense implying not the guarantee of an answer, but at least that of an informing response. Here, what I'm seeking is an informing response to what are the characteristics of the perception of the world, that's my Scottish part world, brought about in using technical objects, technical processes, and technical theories. Man and woman can experience or know several worlds. There is Edmund Husserl's Lebensfeld, the life world, the world as lived and experienced. There is Martin Heidegger's In der Welt sein, being in the world, which recognizes the existential fabric of everyday life. There is Fernand Braudel's Structures of Everyday Life, with its components of daily life and material life, and so forth. Experience and hence knowledge of these worlds range from that gained by ordinary sense perception through that of everything that is taken for granted to that of the pre-Socratic phenomenological condition of being embedded in the world. The range extends from the ontic to the ontological. At least three approaches claim knowledge of the world that lies beyond the everyday, beyond the noble and beyond the sensed. Each approach holds that the realm beyond the everyday is not chaos, but cosmos, and that their logic is valid. The contenders are religion, metaphysics, and the natural sciences. Jürgen Habermas, borrowing an idea from Max Weber, recently characterized cultural modernity, quote, as the separation of substantive reason expressed in religion and metaphysics into three autonomous spheres of science, morality, and art. Each of these has its specific aspects of validity, truth, normative rightness, authenticity, and beauty, with its structures of cognitive instrumental for science, moral practical for ethics, and aesthetic expressive for aesthetics. Habermas bemoans this differentiation of truth, goodness, and beauty, or for those of you up the hill, firmness, commodity, and delight. It, quote, has come to mean the autonomy of the segments treated by the specialists and their separation from the hermeneutics of everyday communication. End of quote. The Enlightenment, it would seem, shed no light on either the world as experienced or the realm beyond everyday experience. That realm, as Lao Tzu would have it, the one we look for beyond seeing and call the unseen, listen for beyond hearing and call the unheard, grasp for beyond reaching and call the withheld. There is a fourth but muted claim to understanding the world of the everyday and its macro and microcosms. That claim is made by Homo Faber, or Man the Builder. And it's the result of mediation at two levels. I suppose we don't know too much about it, because the builders don't say too much about it, they build. The first level of mediation is in the production of the built world, in the mediation between societies and their natural environments. The second is in the use of instruments during his praxis, of representing the world which he intends or proposes to build. The two levels of mediation that we have a passion for in our little program is production, and we agree with Karl Marx here that it's man's fundamental activity, is productive interchange with nature. And we're interested in all the tools and processes and theories that mediate between us and the world in representing the world. The production of artifacts obliges the builder to face the facticity of the world. This relationship with the world is, as Heidegger says, quote, the kind of dealing that is closest to us. Not a bare perceptual cognition, but rather the kind of concern which manipulates things and puts them to use. And this has its own kind of knowledge. This has its own kind of knowledge. Not science, not metaphysics, not religion. It's another way of knowing the world, by building. In these attempts to understand his relationship to the world, the builder calls into service those entities which serve phenomenologically, those which are used or which are to be found in the course of production. Such entities are pragmata or equipment, which are seen as essentially something in order to. These pragmata or equipment are technical objects and will be referred to in this talk as techniques. Techniques always exist in an arrangement or as a totality of equipment. Since they are part of a contextual or referential totality, as in hammer, nail, wood, stud, wall assembly, room, and so on. The characteristics of a technique derives from its use. It exists in order to. Whereas theoretical behavior, this is a quote, theoretical behavior is just looking without circumspection, where circumspection means looking around for a way to get something done. The world of this fourth claimant, the person who claims to know the world through building, is experienced, the world of this fourth claimant is experienced or dealt with through the mediation of techniques, which are technical objects, which are contextually arranged as techniques, which are technical processes, and are understood from the dialectic between action and reflection or technology, that is to say, technical theories. You'll see we're in the bondage of not accepting the separation between art and science, but preferring to deal with techne as the pre-Socratic techne, where there was no separation between art and science. And coming from an architectural school, we have to believe that. That's our only reason to be in the university, otherwise they would say we were a trade school, which they do anyway. Restated briefly, therefore, the question becomes, the question that I think might be worth asking, for which I seek an informing response, which will just make me ask another question. The question becomes, what are the characteristics of such an understanding of the world which is acquired through the use of techniques, and technology? Maurice Merleau-Ponty and Martin Heidegger are two of those thinkers who have found, for me, the most informing responses to the question concerning technology. And my analysis of the question will examine an important idea presented by each of them. I have a longer version where I have the Benjamin question, but I've left the Benjamin question out because we're here for an hour, I'm told. First, Merleau-Ponty's idea that the blind man experiences the world at the tip of his cane. He's not the first to have said that. And second, Heidegger's claim that man lives in the space opened up by equipment. The first characteristic coming out of Merleau-Ponty, then, let me use the key words. Transparency and opacity, and I will give credit to those of us, to those in the history and philosophy of science and technology who have, in fact, used these terms. So this is the first characteristic I want to investigate in response to Merleau-Ponty's notion that the blind man experiences the world at the end of his cane. And then I'll have another set of ideas related to Martin Heidegger's notion that man lives in the space opened up by production, by equipment. Merleau-Ponty's blind man experiences aspects of this world, in this case the ground underfoot, at the tip of his cane. Is the ground high or low, wet or dry, hard or soft, hot or cold, or so forth? it is critical to notice that the characteristic the blind man seeks are those of the ground and not of the cane. The cane, in fact, is unnoticed. It withdraws and becomes a transparent technique. If, in using a hammer, which is the case study that Heidegger uses a lot, quote, that which we concern ourselves primarily is the work, and it is this materiality of the work that we experience, then the hammer withdraws or becomes transparent. Think on a wooden hammer, wooden handle versus a neoprene one. Perfect transparency exists only where there is no mediation. That is, in a non-technic situation. In the above case, the blind man will either have to crawl using his hands as technics or recover his sight. We can experience either of two extremes. Perfect transparency, that is, no mediation, or its opposite, the totally mediated situation in which one experiences not the world at the end of your technic. If you have difficulty with the word technic, think of tool, but tool. But there's machines and there's automata, so I prefer technique. Or its opposite, the totally mediated situation in which one experiences not the world, but the machine itself, which in turn is encountering the world. In the latter case, the world is opaque to man. And it is not the technique that withdraws, but rather it is the world that recedes. A vast range of experiences exists between these two extremes, from that of encountering the world through techniques and as a result of the loss in transparency. Loss in transparency, what's happening? Something's becoming opaque. To that of an experience of techniques, where man experiences the characteristic of the technique. Man experiences the characteristic of the technique, and it is the technique that experiences the world. I draw your attention here to Don Ide's Praxis and Techniques and his little paperback on existential techniques. In understanding media, which I believe is in, it's not in disrepute, but it's not in high repute now, Marshall McLuhan characterized the transparent techniques as cool. Let's take it back for those of you who remember the 60s. And opaque techniques are as hot. Cool media are high in participation or completion by the audience. Hot media are therefore low in participation. Cool media and transparent techniques. That means I'm a good draftsman. Include the user. It's very difficult to use computer graphics. You're looking here and things open. Cool media and transparent techniques include the user. Hot media and opaque techniques exclude the user. In our case, to use Heidegger's word, sever the user from the world. A seminar is apparently cool and transparent. A lecture is hot and opaque. The rustic is cool. The city slicker is hot. Smooth nylon stockings are hot. The open mesh lace or silk stocking is cool because the eye must act as a hand in filling in and completing the image. Insensitive machines are hot and opaque. Sensuous man is cool and transparent. Historically, the development of man the builder's mode of production resulted in a loss of transparency or a gain in opacity. My grandfather reaped the field, that's before we moved from the country to the city, with a short-handed sickle. My father reduced the stress in his back by using the long-handled scythe. I experienced the cutting of grass with a hand-driven lawnmower. My daughter encounters the characteristics of grass with a fuel-powered, even self-propelled propelled, hand-guided mower. That's how they learn to drive now. Her child will use a lawn tractor where the experience is of driving and not of cutting. My great-grandchildren will, in all likelihood, use, if anything, an automaton or a mechanical goat. We find similar losses in transparency in our move from the primitive hut through the log cabin to the heavy timber frame, and finally to the balloon and platform frame house. The shift occurs within the mode of production in cutting and preparing the lumber. The techniques change from the maul, the hammer and wedge, to the adze, fluted columns, to the axe, to the handsaw, to the bandsaw, and finally to the sawmill. Finally, there's no tree. This exclusion of the producer from the mode of production, that is, the increasing opacity as the world recedes, occurs not only in the changing characteristics of the techniques, but also in the technical processes, that is, the techniques, and the technical theories. Technology, or as we would have it, the logos of the techni. It's about time that word had a decent definition instead of computer. The discourse on techni. It's my interest. The discourse on techni, and techni is how you know the world through action and reflection. Reflection and action. The feedback loop. My colleague, who teaches the other half of technology, teaches semiotics. And he's interested in the techni of the logos. Just for the symmetry of it. We're both very good friends. He's interested in the skill of argument about architectural theory. I'm interested in the argument about the skill of production. But he was trained in Venice, and I was born near a steel mill in a coal mine. In making and using transparent techniques, for example, the hammer, the builder designs, controls or manipulates, and provides the energy. The earliest machines replaced the energy, the human energy, with an extrinsic source of power. 3 down to 2. The introduction of servo mechanisms made man the manipulator redundant, down to 1. He became man the designer, soon to be replaced by the self-designing automaton, the auto-automata. Architects are beginning to have to reevaluate what they're being trained for. Man the builder, we have to change that term, I know, for your... man the builder, having superimposed a built environment on top of the natural world, will eventually experience only the built world, which mediates between him and the natural world. You don't have to go back to Archigram and walk around with your own air and all that sort of thing. I know we still have light and breathing, but it's becoming clearer and clearer we experience our world and not the natural world. Huh? I don't know who made that one. Paradoxically, Homo faber, who set out to interact with the world and perhaps understand it and not epistemologically, has created an opaque level of inquiry where even the sensate relations to the natural world have been replaced by the existential pleasures of engineering, or Zen in the art of archery, or Zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance. Thus, technique too has become opaque. And this new hardened environment, supernature, according to Ortega y Gasset, you put supernature on top of nature. But there's also the very interesting work is going on super-supernature, because the world is very difficult out there in the city. And the architects don't mediate anymore. It's the Sony Walkman and the VCR, and architects are not designing them. But you're not all architects. It's a multidisciplinary group. Anyway, the people who are building the new world are not the people who built the old world. So we have this technique has become opaque in this new hardened environment, layered on top of the natural world, is the contemporary garden of facilities, or Eden. In a similar fashion, Paris I'm thinking of when I think of Eden, I'm not thinking of Philadelphia. In a similar fashion, technology, or technical theories, partakes in this enframing with the concomitant loss in transparency. Over time, our ways of understanding have shifted from, simplified version, of knowing through doing, craft, to borrowing intellectual frameworks from other disciplines or phenomena, empiricism, to constructing theories based on systematic methodological observation of the material at hand itself, applied science or engineering. When an applied scientific theory exists, the reality of the built design must conform to the theory, albeit with a factor of safety to compensate for the lack of correlation between theory and practice. Where no good theory is available, the builder is controlled by regulations, such as standards, codes, etc., all based on the collective experience. Maybe because the builder is not sure what to say about ethics, society doesn't trust them, so that's why you have those codes. Or is it because there's no good explicit theory? Look at the history of the factor of safety in steel getting lower and lower, and concrete getting lower. But what are they for different materials? In some cases where good practice was established in pre-scientific times, that's a quote pre-scientific times, the common sense rules of thumb of craft were and often still are sufficient justification to build. Our knowledge of structural steel is applied scientific. Our knowledge of reinforced concrete is empirical. And our understanding of brick masonry is still based in craft. The manufacture of steel products is applied scientific. Their fabrication is empirical, and the logic of their assembly into a building is understood by the contractor alone. At present, inexorable shifts are taking place away from craft knowledge and towards the theories of applied science. Thus, technology, technical theories, too, is becoming opaque. And increasingly, we can perceive the realm of building only through the filters of the theories of applied science. Among those involved in building, the architect, who favors the primacy of perception, prefers, not unexpectedly, the transparency of arts and crafts to the opacity of machine reproduction. Since the experiment from which an architect might derive a theory is for the most part dependent on the buildings of the past, and since those productions were built using transparent techniques, and technology, the architect's perception has been and continues to be receptive of and encouraging to transparent modes of production. Thus, architects continue to favor. I have a little table. The thing we're photocopying is a list of transparent and opaque. The architect continues to favor. A large percentage of architects continue to favor transparent passive solar heating and cooling over opaque mechanical heating, ventilating, and air conditioning. In fact, you'd better if you have a consultant for that. Adds fluted stone columns to rolled and fabricated steel sections, the rediscovery of Mies van der Rohe notwithstanding. Charcoal ink and watercolor drawings to computer graphics. The phenomenological investigations of Lucan, Luis Barragan, and Carlos Scarpa over the styles of postmodernism and high tech. I apologize to the postmodernists and high tech here, but it's too opaque for many architects. Also, most of it is not technical, most of it's aesthetic. Architects prefer to be in the presence of architecture rather than to study architecture in the academy. It does not make sense to study it in school. Be better going out there and sitting a few minutes with LaBruce building. There's a preference for the live theatre over the cinema. That's in dispute now. It applies to the older faculty. There's a preference of sailing with the power of the wind and the feel of the water to the powered motorboat. It's rather vulgar to have a powered motorboat in architectural school. We all want to win the America's Cup. I used to say the Ferrari and Cadillac, but the sociologist gave me hell for that, so I've changed it to the the architect prefers the Porsche and the country road to the Mercedes and the turnpike. You can't, you know, just feel those big tires instead of, you can, Well, I drive a 911, so I feel the road. Designing, architects prefer to design for rural regions, even developing countries, to infill and over infill in the city and developed countries. That may be recently. My question is, is then the architect's position one that says a good technology is one that withdraws? Is a preference for transparency and low technology a desire for no technology? Or is it that the architects agree with Heidegger that, quote, things which are closest to us are in themselves and are encountered in themselves, and that the architect is engaged in the task of revealing the fundamental ontology of man through the act of building? The second characteristic, amplification and reduction. Amplification and reduction. In Being and Time, Heidegger notes that man encounters the world through equipment. And since we use this equipment in order to do something, it has the character of closeness. And that the closeness of this equipment has been given directionality. You do this with it, you don't do that with it. Quote, equipment has been essentially fitted up and installed, set up and put to rights. Equipment has its place, or else it just lies around. When equipment for something or other has its place, this place defines itself as the place of this equipment. It's a bit tautological in Philadelphia, but you'll understand it because this is all Black Forest stuff. An item of equipment belongs somewhere. I sensed the Black Forest as I just drove from Syracuse. I thought maybe I was carrying coals to Newcastle. You would all understand this, and it makes sense to talk about it in the city, but since you're one with nature. This dimension, well, there's not too much of an artificial environment here. There's a neon one. This dimensionality of space is still veiled in the spatiality of the ready-to-hand. What a super idea. Tools occupy space, techniques occupy space, they open up space, and theories open up spaces. You live in the space of your tools, your techniques, and your technology. So, if you want to live in another space, you better change your cassette. Ready-to-hand equipment is something in order to do something. What are the characteristics of this relationship between equipment and the place or space that humans encounter in using that equipment? Let's take an example from visual perception. At the scale of the body, the human eye is one of the mediators. Visual perception is the mediator, or technique, that receives information regarding the world. Whether the world is perceived as chaos or cosmos, or if you're that clever Irishman, you talk about chaosmos in Finnegan's Wake, the world is perceived as chaos or cosmos is decided by another human mediator, the brain. To encounter visually the microcosm, cosmos, the world, one uses the microscopos, the watcher, as a technique. To encounter visually the macrocosm, one uses the macroscope, or the telescope. It used to be that the macrocosm was interesting to study. Now it's the microcosm, it's the hot stuff. Unfortunately, those of us who live in the world and lay bricks on top of each other don't live in the microcosm or the macrocosm. The prefix tele, T-E-L-E, indicates far or at a distance. And the scope acts in bringing far things nearer, in the sense here of the visual. Similarly, in telecommunications, one encounters the telephone for sound, the telegraph for the drawn message, television, pictures. Additionally, there's telemechanics, things moved by radio. And something they did not encourage in Scotland, any telepathy, emotional influence. Emotion is eradicated early on. And then, for those of you who bend spoons, telekinesis. No material connection at all, and so forth. There's lots of tellies around. For Heidegger, quote, spatiality shows the characteristic of deseverance and directionality, where deseverance means abolishing a distance or farness rather than enhancing it. Thus, we have made the things observed less remote. And directionality means a route to be taken. Desevering, quote, desevering amounts to making farness vanish. That is, making the remoteness of something disappear, bringing it close. Essentially, something at a distance enters the space of the observer. Hence, there's an extension of a sense through the use of a technique. There is an amplification of a sense. I lived in IMP, Society Hill Towers, for many years, and the three towers adjacent to each other, and I did not know that Philadelphia was full of astronomers. All these apartment buildings, many of them had enormous telescopes. People would call and say, have you looked at the star on the 15th floor? The problem is that the activity with the telescope, one encounters the visual characteristics of the distant object. The activity or object cannot be heard. The missing technique is the telephone. Do you remember the movie? What was it, that one on the... He couldn't find the bug at the end. You can hear at a distance now, too. Yes. Yes. Very important. So not only can I not hear what's going on in that apartment, it can't be touched. I want to patent a machine called the teletact. It can't be smelled, so I'm going to invent a telefume. It can't be tasted. Telegust or teletang, have your fancy. For phenomenological man, the greatest loss is that the sense of place cannot be experienced. We don't have a tele... Topophilia? Thus, any technique, in the case I use the telescope, is an amplifying of an isolated sense or senses, and it brings with it a concomitant loss or reduction in total experience. Characteristically, therefore, techniques or media mediate through amplification or isolation of senses, and the user's experience encounters a concomitant reduction or loss of senses, or as we would like to say, in homage to someone, there's a forgetting of being. As this, what is it, some country in the Far East says, it's the nail that sticks up that gets hit in the head. So don't stand out from the crowd. We're more interested in the notion that he who has a hammer goes around thinking the world is just made of nails. As we previously asked, with respect to transparency and opacity, we might ask here whether techniques, processes, and technology, theories, mediate in the same manner as techniques. That is, through amplification and reduction. Considering techniques, we find many cases where the optimization of the production process, the means, becomes the major determinant of form. And the product, the ends, is the result of that theory of production of efficiency. That is, the means has become the ends. Sounds like Jacques Ellul. Or there is an amplification of means and a reduction of ends. Considering technology or technical theories, we find that different geometries, for example, Euclidean, Riemannian, or topology, and so forth, represent different perceptions of the world and lead to different logics of composition, each based on a particular amplification or reduction of geometrical relationships. We did struggle in the 60s in the architectural schools with topology, but we always fall back in Euclidean geometry. Well, we don't fall back in any geometry now. Beyond the question of the relationship of techniques, and technology to space, it is also worth asking, I found it worth asking, what are the conditions, what are the circumstances, what are the contexts that seek a response from techniques, and technology, and shape their characteristics of transparency, opacity, amplification, reduction. Since technical objects, processes, and theories mediate between individuals and societies and their natural worlds, the conditions for a specific formal response might derive from three settings: the physicality of the natural world, the civil and cultural agenda of the society, and the intentionality of the individual human. Physicality, the social cultural agenda, two different, and intentionality as the three. When we're being really coarse and profane, we call it physis, logos, and poiesis. In his encounters with the physicality of the natural world, Homo Faber finds himself surrounded by difficulties which threaten his existence and with facilities available for overcoming such difficulties. You'll notice Ortega y Gasset's argument on thoughts and technology, or man the technician. When these difficulties are severe, as in extreme climates of either heat or cold, the technique seeks to overcome only the characteristic of the difficulty. In extreme dry heat, he builds a thick wall and a courtyard. Wet heat demands a different response. In extreme cold, given the available material, he builds an igloo or a fire. Or he changes his goal from survival to death. That's a possibility. Might get pleasure out of death. Or you could, well, you've read your cybernetics, you know all the alternatives. When the difficulty is not climatic, but concerns effort to span a great distance with a bridge, or reach a great height with a tower, the characteristic of the mediator is once more towards amplification of the condition. In this case, a structural solution is the major determinant of form. That's why all our tall buildings end up being layout of that. Elevators, heat loss, heat gain, structure. And they still don't know what's the base, the shaft, and the cap, if that's the language. And if in studio, in the design studio, we're saying, we'll take you in an extreme condition. You want to understand weather? We're going to put you in the tundra. Or we're going to put you in the desert. Always putting those extreme conditions. Sometimes, of course, the code chooses it for you. In the world, if the world surrounds man with facilities, there's no need to intervene. That's what the beautiful people do. They just follow the sun. As Ortega y Gasset observes, quote, what in reality prevails is that man finds the world surrounds himself as an intricate net woven of both facilities and difficulties. In such a case, specific conditions do not exist on insist on recognition. And there are no obvious characteristics to the techniques, and technology. What then are the characteristics of, for example, a wall, a roof, or any other building as some kind of mediation? Consider the case of the roof. It's an element which mediates between several realms. Between human and human, it serves as a defensive technique. You may think of the lion jumping over your wall. Between human and the built world, it must relate to both, say, the scale of the city, St. Paul's outside dome, and to the scale of man, the internal dome. Let's put a structural one in between, picking up the lantern. Between the human realm and the natural world, we find many facilities and difficulties. But what experience do we seek of the path of the sun?